Welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. My name is Alice Thwaite, and I'm the founder and editor-in-chief of the Echo Chamber Club. As you may or may not know, the Echo Chamber Club podcast stands as a contrast to the newsletters that we send out weekly. We seek to find thinkers, academics, activists, philosophers, very interesting people who would call themselves liberal and progressive, to tell us about what motivates them, what their values are, and what that actually means in 2017. Today, I'm with Arik Chowdhury. He's the CEO of Webroots Democracy, which he founded 4 years ago. It's a youth-led think tank focused on the intersection of technology and democratic participation. As CEO, he's been leading the campaign for online voting, has been working with politicians, charities, think tanks, and technology companies on researching the benefits and challenges of a digital democracy. Welcome, Arik.
Hi, Alice.
Hi. So, let's start talking about your motivations. So at a very young age, you chose to start a think tank. What was the inspiration behind that?
Basically started in my undergrad studies at Birmingham Uni, where I was studying economics and political science. And my final year, I was in a political science dissertation around the impact of the internet on political participation. And then a small part of that looked at the potential of online voting. And a couple of years afterwards, I think 2014 it was, started to think that really no one's actually doing anything about the sort of very low levels of electoral participation in the UK. So if you look at elections such as local council elections or police and crime commissioner elections, or the elections to devolved governments in Wales and Scotland, you often see voter turnouts of less than 50%. And so part of this was looking at ways we can use technology to actually boost voter turnout. That was the initial sort of inspiration, and mainly looking towards younger voters who at that point, in every general election since 1997, I think, had voted turnout of less than 50%. And that went up slightly this year. There's a lot of fake news swirling around about a 72% youth voter turnout, which actually was nearer the mark, around 55%. So still the lowest voting group of all ages. For comparable figures, if you look at older voters over 65, you're looking around late 70s, early 80% voter turnout. As it's developed, it has looked at other areas of digital democracy, and it's also looked at, so that this is looking at ways, other ways we can use technology to improve our democratic system. So looking at things like the ways we can use technology to boost voter education, looking at ways, looking at how, for example, social media influences elections. But also along that time, I've noticed that actually the main beneficiaries of this kind of technology is voters with disabilities and vision impairments, who I feel are often the most left out group, I would say, in our democratic conversation. So for example, if you're blind or you have a bedbound disability, it's very difficult for you to even cast an independent ballot in an election. And casting a vote in an election, in my view, is the minimum level of political participation we should all be aspiring to. So for me, it's a big issue that I want to tackle through this think tank, doing research, talking to politicians, and getting them really on board with these new ideas.
Cool. So I suppose you've spoken about a number of different challenges there, because when you think about disabilities and visual impairments, that's kind of a infrastructure challenge when it comes to actually how we vote, whereas youth turnout is more of a persuasion challenge, trying to convince young voters why they should vote. What, as part of all of this, would you say that your values then stem from access and equality? And if not, then tell me why not. And if so, then what do those things mean to you?
I'd say it stems from an ambition to see a sort of a more thriving democracy. I mean, at the moment, I don't really see what we have in the UK as a very strong democracy. When you see, so our research basically showed that in 95%, that there's 20,000 roughly elected politicians in the UK, and 95% of them were elected with less than 50% of people turning out, right? So I see that as a terrible state for democracy. And the only real exceptions to that is a general election or a referendum, right? And even in, if you take the EU referendum, there's like 12 million people didn't take part. So that's just, that's quite a big problem. So that's around 30% of the electorate. But in areas in terms of access and equality, that is more of an infrastructure thing, especially for, you know, disabled people and vision impaired people. This is actually goes against their human rights in the UN Convention, which is, so some countries which have introduced this have looked at it from that angle and just said there are actual democracies that haven't even afforded equal rights to every citizen when it comes to participating in democracy. In terms of younger people, I totally agree. It's about persuading, you know, the bulk of it's about persuading young people that politics matters, and that the political system is important. So I don't believe, so some people will tell you that young people are apathetic, which I think is, you know, completely untrue. I think young people do care about politics. I mean, if you talk to them about housing or education and jobs, they'll care about it, right? It's kind of the political process itself that I think people don't engage with. So Westminster, do people really know who their MP even is? But in terms of the actual process there, if you look, for example, some of the other big problems with young people is actually getting them to register to vote, to be on the electoral roll. And one way technology has been used quite well in recent years is the introduction of online voter registration, which was introduced a couple of years ago. And you now see hundreds of thousands of young people registering around election time because it's online, because people are pushing it out on Twitter, on Facebook. So, for example, Facebook had an embedded button on their homepage saying you registered to vote. You had celebrities on Twitter pushing it out. And that's really where I see technology advancing our process. It's not the platform itself. It's the way the platform is promoted. And at the moment, we have a very old-fashioned, outdated system, I would argue. So, for example, if you look at the next general election will be in 2022, the first time voters, so the 18, 19-year-olds in that election, this will be the first generation of voters born in the 21st century. They won't remember a world before smartphones, social media, things like this. So, for example, Facebook founded in 2004, Twitter 2006. First iPhone, I can't remember when that was, maybe 2005. So you're going to have a whole generation of largely digital natives. And I believe things like polling stations will eventually be seen as like the telephone box outside, quite ancient and old-fashioned thing that people, that doesn't really fit in with people's lives. It's not a case of them being lazy or anything. It's just a case of the system being alien. So that's one thing I really want to change. I want to have an ever-evolving system that keeps up to date with the way that people live their lives.
Can I ask something? Because you said a bit earlier something very interesting. It's the way the platform is promoted, it's not the platform itself. Yeah. I've heard discussions previously around electoral turnout, around whether or not it's the people that need changing or it's the system that needs changing. If you talk about platform promotion, that seems to be kind of halfway in between those two things, right? Could you elaborate a little bit more on what that means?
So, for example, if you created an online voting platform that no one knows about, like, no one's going to vote, right? It doesn't make a difference. And that's kind of the problem, actually, with a lot of elections now. I mean, the elections and votes that get the most media attention are general elections and referendum. No one really, a lot of people, I think, are unaware of like local council elections taking place. And that largely is because it's quite expensive to promote these things. They don't always get national media attention. And the way online voting could change that is, for example, by integrating it with social media. So I mentioned earlier about the voter registration being embedded onto Facebook and being promoted via Twitter. Had a similar thing targeted by location. So, for example, let's say there's local council elections taking place in Manchester. You can have Facebook targeting every Facebook user in Manchester, letting them know that there's a council election taking place that week or on that day. And it's really through that kind of promotion that you then see people becoming aware that there's an election, and perhaps even on that online platform, you could have information about that election, information about candidates, information about their policies. And so it's really the way you use and promote it in that sense, I think you would see an impact on participation that you wouldn't see in the current system, where it is largely paper-based and dependent on there being national media coverage for people to really be aware of these things.
Well, it's an interesting point, because the Echo Chamber Club is also all around access to information rather than information itself. Let's move on from participation in elections onto other concerns that you might have. So, yeah, do you want to elaborate more on your other values that you hold other than access to and granting everyone access to voting elections?
So more generally, in terms of like my world values, or...
Yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit more about them. Like what you know, what
does... Other things that worry me generally are things around, at the moment, I would say it's a rise of extreme far-right values and the sort of normalization of racism and the sort of disregard for political correctness. And so, for example, I see political correctness as just another word for respecting others and being kind, essentially. And I feel now that we have a mainstream voice against that, and a sort of mainstream voice that promotes divisions amongst people based on skin color. And you can see this in America with Donald Trump being their president. You saw recently in Germany the election of 90 members of parliament from a anti-Islam far-right party. And I think in this country, I think it's almost taboo to say that there's any sort of racist drive behind the Brexit vote, right? In my opinion, there was. I think a large part of Brexit was due to people wanting to get rid of immigrants from their country, whether they're European or not. These are other things that worry me. So I do feel like we're going backwards in some respects in terms of just equality, essentially, racial equality, primarily, I would say. And it's quite worrying. I think there's a bit of a vacuum. I think people are too scared to sort of talk in favor of racial equality for fear of being labeled as like politically correct. I mean, in the past, I think a few years ago even, it wouldn't be just labeled political correctness, it would be PC gone mad. And we've gone from people being labeled PC gone mad just being labeled PC, and this is a bad thing, right? So these are other things I would say that worry me significantly. So whenever I can chip in here or there, I'll try and do something to fill that vacuum and be a pro-equality voice in that sense.
So it seems in general, the thing, like, to summarise what your values are, what you care about the most is equality, whether or not that's equality of access to voting booths or equality in the system.
I'd agree with that. And it filters into the views on economics as well. I'd like to see an economy that recognises privileges that people are born with. So I feel, you know, there are some people who believe, you know, every success that they have in their life is down to them and their hard work, which I would consider hard work to be a minor percentage of a contributing factor to where people get to in their lives. And I see most of it being down to fortune of being born into for example, a good country like the UK, where you have lots of access to education and healthcare, and but also on top of that, you know, privileges in terms of personal family wealth or connections or parents with university education and things like that. So in terms of equality, in that sense, I think also filters into my economic values, where I believe we should have an economy that balances out, or recognizes privileges and then tries to balance out those privileges and afford opportunities to those who aren't as fortunate to be born into a good family and a good upbringing and good life chances from day one, essentially.
When you kind of put forward that value to other people, what's the main pushback that you get, and what ways presumably you think the pushbacks that you get are unreasonable? I don't suppose you could talk through a little bit of why other people might think you're wrong, and then also what you would say back to those people.
I feel like a lot of this conversation is still kind of academic. So I think, for example, if I was to say there was to be a poll on, for example, whether people understand what privilege is, I think you'd probably be looking at like 5 to 10% really of people who understand what that term means. So I feel like at the moment we still haven't managed to get into the mainstream that conversation. But actually, you know, not everyone has equal opportunities from day one. I think that's a big challenge, is that a lot of these kind of conversations around equality still tend to be academic or within political bubbles. So most people, I think, will just get on with their day-to-day lives and not really consider these things as important when it comes to, for example, voting in governments. I think that's quite a big problem. In terms of
you carry on.
In terms of other things like, you know, racism and things like that, I think the arguments for racism are probably easier to understand than the arguments against it. So, for example, with the Brexit vote, it's quite easy to understand the argument that, you know, if we have too many immigrants coming here, schools will be overwhelmed, public services will be overwhelmed. There's too much supply in the economy, so wages will decrease. And that's quite an easy argument to understand, more so than an argument of, you know, we all share one planet, we're all similar people to each other, we're all working just as hard as each other. You know, and there's things about maintaining our economy to match things like population growth and things like that. I think those are a little less sexy arguments, I'd say. So I think that's quite a big problem. I just think there's a vacuum of voices really putting forward these ideas. I feel like parties have become complacent in this country. So, for example, if you take the Labour Party, I often consider the Labour Party to have become complacent on racism, or kind of taking votes for granted often. So, you know, there's this whole idea of people of colour voting Labour as a given, right? And I think that's sort of changing now. And that's, you know, the reason why that was in the first place is because Labour was a voice, an anti-racism voice throughout the 60s and 70s, and no one else was really talking in favour of BME people. And now I think you're seeing new generations who don't remember any of that and are now looking at what political parties are offering today. And I think that's a big problem there. I think there's a total vacuum of voices putting forward pro-equality arguments in a language that everyone can understand. Whereas on the other hand, there's this, you know, tons of voices giving the anti-immigrant argument, and it's become quite mainstream, I would argue. And one of the problems, I think, with a lot of progressive people is that they tend to use academic terms too often. So even, for example, I would say the term socialist is used too much, because I don't think people understand what socialism is. I mean, I would struggle to define socialism very well, and I'm, you know, study political science, at university, and you would see on the other hand, on the more conservative side of the political debate, using language that people can understand in their day-to-day lives. So comparing the economy to, for example, family finances, right? And I think that's quite smart. And I think this is a big problem on the left and more progressive side of politics, is they aren't speaking a language. A, they're not putting forward the arguments, and B, they're not speaking a language that normal people will understand.
Quickly, to kind of talk about what you mentioned before about this idea about the fact that we're not engaging, we need more voices. I've often thought about participation, the fact that people don't vote in local council elections, because to what extent should making political decisions be part of an ordinary person's life? Do you think it's acceptable for someone to say, look, I'll vote once every 4 years, but I'd like to see it as a representative democracy, so I don't need to constantly be thinking about these big decisions, because it's kind of exhausting, right? What's your take on, you know, how much participation is enough?
This is my worry. I mean, I think voting once every 4 years is the minimum level of participation, and voting in things like your local council elections, it should be the minimum. I mean, these are like 5-minute tasks, essentially, right? And we're struggling to do that as a population. The majority of the population in the majority of times is struggling to do that. As for in between, however, I wouldn't argue for compulsory voting either, mainly because I see that I think people should have a right to reject the idea of democracy, or to, you know, boycott the ballot box in any given election beyond actually casting a spoiled ballot. However, in between elections, participation doesn't necessarily have to be voting. Say, for example, I also wouldn't want to see a situation where you're having referendums on a regular basis, like you have in Switzerland, on different issues. You know, participation can be as much as, engaging with your local politicians on issues, taking part in campaigns, or even just staying aware, to be honest, of the political debate and educating yourself. I think at the moment we have a deficit, I would say, in sort of political education in this country. I think it should be made mandatory in schools. I think this is another good argument actually for lowering the voting age to 16, so that you can actually reach young people whilst they're in school and almost force them to be interested. At the moment, when they're 18, they often leave their home, or whether that's going to university or starting work. Makes it a lot more difficult then to engage them in their sort of deeper understandings of our political process and our political system. But at the moment, I just see a big problem in terms of our minimum level of participation has gone out the window, essentially. And I don't see, I mean, A, there's no incentive for politicians to actually act on this, because they already have a system that's putting them in power. For them, it'd be like fixing a system that isn't broken there, right? But I see this as a big problem. I see just getting that minimum level of participation being a huge challenge that isn't being addressed at the moment, never mind the fact that, you know, politicians themselves aren't being representative. And I think actually if you did get more people voting and paying attention to politics, you'd see a change in the kind of people who stand in politics and the kind of views that they represent. So at the moment, if you look at young versus old, right, you'll see a lot of older people vote in elections and hardly any young people vote. And you see a translation in policies by governments which cater more towards older people and less towards younger people. And that can be a trebling of tuition fees for younger people, a lower minimum wage for under 21-year-olds, terrible situation in the housing market for younger people. Whereas on the flip side, for older people, you're seeing, you know, free bus passes, a lot more generous pension payments for older people today than there will be for the future. Better housing situation, because those generations vote more, right? Kind of similar again for BME voters personally. Even though it goes against some of my political values, I'd quite like to see BME voters being a lot more fluid in their vote and voting for different parties, just so that politicians then start to pay attention more to them and start taking them less for granted. I think with great participation, you'd see greater changes in how politics is actually run in this country.
So to wrap up this conversation, Arik, I don't suppose I could ask you, because this is the Echo Chamber Club, what you've read which kind of challenges your values, if there's anything that people can maybe access to get out of their echo chamber of perhaps reading The Guardian, reading the BBC, reading mainstream newspapers. Any interesting blogs, podcasts, books, anything that you could just quickly pass on?
Don't know about anything specific I've read. I mean, one thing I'm sure everyone has come across recently, there is this whole Uber debate. I think it's challenged me a lot in my political views. And that's mainly in terms of being a very pro-technology person. I was quite annoyed at first that a authority were trying to ban Uber in a city, which Uber I see as as not just better than taxis and private hire taxi services. I see it as a genius solution, right? Far superior for drivers and customers. However, on the flip side, it's kind of conflicts in my views when I read the arguments for, strong regulation of major corporations, which Uber is, and how this is one of the few situations where the state can actually enforce regulation upon a big company in a way that you can't do for organizations like Google or Starbucks. You can actually revoke a license. Now, that's something that's massively made me think in the past couple of weeks, really made me question my values. Am I pro technology and innovation? Because I also saw this as a bit of a protectionist move by Transport for London. But on the other hand, all companies, technology or not, should be abiding by democratic regulations, right? So I think I've actually flipped 180 from being almost signing that petition to save Uber to being TFL's right. Maybe it should be sort there.
I know. This is a conversation that could last a very long time, especially me.
Yeah.
but yeah, it just drives me mad the way that people call it an Uber ban when it's not been banned.
Yeah.
It's just a flat any.
No,
and that's
also
they
have very clever PR, I think.
Yeah,
very
amazing.
Clever PR.
But we are going to have to wrap it up. Maybe we could talk about Uber another day. But thank you so much for speaking with me today, Arik.
It was really nice to chat.
Thanks, Arik, for chatting with me for the Echo Chamber Club podcast. You can get involved with Webroots Democracy via the website, which is webrootsdemocracy.org. I'm Alice Thwaite, and you can contact me via editor@echochamber.club. And don't forget, if you haven't already, to sign up to our newsletter on the website, which is echochamber.club. If you like this podcast, please do share us with a friend, because it really does help spread the word about what we're doing. And we look forward to speaking or talking to you next time. Bye-bye.